to Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. The Paris Climate Talks brought together high-level negotiators from nearly 200 nations from across the planet to discuss and agree on measures to address climate change. What does a climate deal mean for the world? Did it achieve what was needed to avert the worst impacts of human-caused climate change? Or was it too little too late, as many climate activists say? Here to talk more about the Paris Climate Talks is my guest, Sister Joan Brown, a Franciscan sister from the Rochester, Minnesota Franciscan community. Sister Joan is also the executive director of New Mexico Interfaith Power and Light, that works to educate and inspire faith communities and individuals, engage them in energy efficiency, renewable energy, and local food, and work with people of faith to emphasize the moral implications of various public policy concerns at the local, state, and federal levels. Sister Joan was in Paris as one of the representatives of Franciscans International at the Climate Talks, and we're very pleased to have her here today to provide us with this debrief. So welcome, Joan, and welcome home.
Well, thanks so much, Allison. And it's wonderful to be on your show again. And with everybody down there in Silver City, I just love folks in Silver City, so this is great. Thank you.
Great. So let's give our listeners a bit of background on the Paris Climate Talks. Why did this unprecedented global event take place, and generally, what was achieved?
Climate change is the most critical issue of our time. And in 1992, the world began to realize this, and so set up what is called the COP, which is the Conference of Parties, and it's through the UN, to come up with ways working together as a world to address this enormous issue. And since then, we've had the Kyoto Protocol, which was never ratified by the United States, and I was at the Copenhagen large meeting of the COP 6 years ago in 2009, and that meeting ended basically with nothing happening. It was a huge disappointment. So the next scheduled large meeting, they have meetings every year, but this was the next scheduled large meeting in Paris. And so what happened with this one is they began a different kind of a process, and Ban Ki-moon and others in the Paris Party, and beginning with Durban, South Africa, set forth that what we would have is individual nations submitting proposals of how they were going to reduce their emissions and then move towards reductions practically, through renewable energy, through forestation, all of those kinds of things. So it was very significant because we are so deep into climate change. We're already seeing the effects with our migration, immigrant issues, many, many people suffering. You know, even during the COP, it was very sorrowful for me that England was having unprecedented floods. And the 2 previous weeks before the COP began, in Chandra, India, they had 5 feet of rain in less than 2 weeks. Over 1 million people displaced and thousands dead. So that's why this COP was so important. And yes, we did come to an agreement. So that was historical and very significant.
So, Joan, what was your role? Who were you representing? Give us a sense, because it sounds like you were an official representative. Tell us what you did.
Well, at the COP, there's room for civil society to be engaged inside the actual negotiating areas to a certain limit. So they can add their voice, they can be observers, official observers. So I was wearing a couple of hats, and I was there. I left here the 1st, and I got back the 13th. And so the first week I was doing some things outside the COP, but then I was inside the official COP the whole second week and through when the agreement was made. So I was a delegate with Franciscans International that is at the UN. And then I also was with Interfaith Power and Light. And Interfaith Power and Light, and I could talk about this more later, but we did a presentation actually before the State Department about what congregations are doing. So in my role, I was inside, and there were many people of faith and other environmental groups, aid agency groups, just a variety of NGOs. And we actually had a part in meeting with Todd Stern, who was one of the chief negotiators of the State Department, and with staff of congressional delegation in the U.S. and others, to bring forth some of the ethical, moral, finance concerns, concerns for loss and damage, to raise the level of those concerns for things that needed to be kept and put into the final agreement.
Yeah, the term loss and damage, that was sort of a buzz concept that got reported in the newspapers. What does loss and damage mean?
Well, loss and damage really came to the forefront more at one of the recent COPs, when people might remember the huge typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, and it occurred during one of the COP meetings. The delegate from the Philippines was distraught. He began to actually fast during the COP and raised the level of the meaning of loss and damage, which is those people who have contributed least to climate change through emissions and usually are the most poor and vulnerable, are the ones being affected the most. So loss and damage, like in that hurricane or in that typhoon, for instance, all the people that lost their homes, lost their livelihoods, their island nations losing their whole land, their whole nation. That is loss and damage from the effects of climate change. And so, and it's usually the developing nations, the poorer countries, and they feel that they should have some kind of help or financial recompense even. Now, what happened in the agreement is that we did get into the agreement a whole separate part where loss and damage is laid out, which is very important. There's no funding associated with it in the agreement, but what it does is it allows for, through the UN process, the ability to address, like, displacement of peoples through these unprecedented storms and things like that. So it's important to have it in there, and especially as we move on into the future, because whatever is in the document, we can build on. So it's quite important into that. Part of the reason there isn't funding is this document is very delicate, not just for the U.S., but for many countries, because what is legal and what isn't. And with the United States, this is not a document that has to go to our Congress to be ratified, even though parts of it are binding, but it's binding in a different way. So that's significant as well.
Wow. So, Joan, what were some of the other agreements as part of the climate talks, some of the other big issues that were agreed to?
One of the large ones that made this more of an ambitious agreement, people did not think that we would come to this, but the nations did, the 200-some nations, is the long-term ambition of not just moving to having 2 degrees Celsius, but with aspirational aspect of having 1.5 degrees to move towards that, which is very significant because 2 degrees is not going to get us there, and even some debate about 1.5. But the groundwork is there for a strong ambition to moving towards that.
Tell our listeners what exactly that means. So you're talking about 1.5 degrees. So what are the emission reductions that would be necessary to keep global average temperatures at 1.5 degrees Celsius? Is that correct?
Yes, 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
So what happened at this COP that made it different is trying to help us move in that direction is the nations submitted 160 nations by the time the COP began, and 120 of those were developing countries, submitted what are called the INDCs, which are basically individual nations' commitments of what they're going to do to help meet this target. And so that means reducing emissions, like through automobiles, through phasing out of coal-fired power plants, by keeping some of the fossil fuels in the ground, by reforestation. So that will make up part of that. Another part would be those aspects that the countries themselves in more of a legislative or a government way. So, for instance, in this country, we're addressing the clean power plan, so that might be part of it. Businesses are also doing things, so that's another aspect of it. The civil society, universities. So there's a whole range of a bunch of players within each country that will help to address this. The other thing that's important is within this, there are some 5-year target cycles so that we can increase these targets as time goes on. There was a lot of conversation, especially by science and business, saying how solar, for instance, has gone down so dramatically, and that maybe, you know, in the next several years, these targets for reducing emissions could go up even more to make it a stronger agreement.
So you mean as renewable energy gets more cost effective or the price goes down, we could actually increase our or improve our goal for emission reductions?
Exactly, and that's okay. A prime example. And with that, for sure, in the developed nations like the U.S., because we are so reliant on fossil fuels, that is going to move pretty radically down the scale. For those developing countries, this I think might be very interesting for our listeners, is some countries are jumping over the need for the fossil fuels. For instance, I talked with some people from Bangladesh. Bangladesh is probably the poorest and most vulnerable climate change country in the world. And in Bangladesh, they are installing 60 to 70,000 solar panels a month.
Wow.
And I asked the person, well, what about all the very poor? What are they doing? They said the government is providing free solar panels to those who are very poor.
Now, that was a pretty big stumbling block, right, in Paris, in terms of between the big carbon emitters of the wealthy countries versus the poorer developing countries that want to grow and improve their standard of living and feel like fossil fuels are maybe part of being able to do that. And how was that resolved? Wasn't there a pledge of resources to try and figure out a low carbon path to development?
Yes, some of that would be through financing of mitigation and adaptation and commitments from businesses and for incentives, loans for those countries to increase renewable energies. But the other thing that I might mention that I think is very significant is the countries themselves are suffering so much from climate change, and they are seeing, and in the United States this is the case, but we're not seeing it yet, it will cost a lot more financially, health-wise, and in future viability of life if we don't act on climate change immediately. A statistic I had was that it would cost 27% less now to address climate change than, say, in 2030. So part of it is the financial, and so they're seeing that. The other is the health implications. Like I just this morning on the news or yesterday, Beijing and another, I think it was Shanghai, their air quality was so poor that they had to close the schools and had limited factories functioning.
Wow.
In this week, because the air quality was so bad, they could not see.
Amazing.
Or breathe.
Right.
So all of these countries, and India the same, they're seeing, you know, well, with this kind of unprecedented weather catastrophes, the expense of that is huge. And they know that this is only going to get worse, and they're already vulnerable. And so there's all kinds of incentives. The major reason I believe that we came up with an agreement as a world, which is hugely difficult, is because everybody realizes this is a crisis, and we have to address it.
Okay, Sister Joan Brown will be right back after this short break, and we'll talk more about the Paris climate talks. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, Director of the Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. My guest today is Sister Joan Brown, Director of the New Mexico Interfaith Power and Light, and we've been talking about the Paris climate talks. Sister Joan just returned from Paris, and we're talking about what was achieved. And, you know, many climate activists were not happy with the Paris agreements. Former NASA scientist James Hansen called the Paris talks, quote, a fraud, and they represented, quote, no action, just promises. And, of course, others have said that the Paris climate talks laid the foundation for solving the climate problem. So, Sister Joan, since you were on the front lines of those discussions and saw it firsthand, what do you think? What were your impressions of what was achieved?
Well, first of all, I could see where a scientist like Jim Hansen would feel like, oh, this isn't enough and it's too late. But I believe, and from being in the room when this agreement was, or in the two rooms, because the delegates were in one room and the overflow was in another. We're talking thousands and thousands and thousands of people. There was excitement, and there was, we finally have something. And actually, a colleague of mine ran into somebody from the Maldives, which is, you know, some island nations that are suffering, and they're going to, you know, lose their whole lives. And they said, we are so grateful that we finally have something. It is about time. So while it is not strong enough, there is room to make this stronger. It really comes down to what the civil society is ready to do and governments to ramp up our actions. And that takes a lot of positive energy and a movement forward. And it is because we really care about the future and the children and our world and our countries and our lives. And those are things that we want to put our energy behind, and that takes positive energy. And so we really do need to work with what we have and move forward.
I agree. And one of the things that people are saying, okay, now that we have this agreement, we have to immediately turn our attentions to getting carbon emissions out of the world economy. And businesses and investors, fossil fuel companies, they clearly have a huge role in achieving that. So now that everyone's heading home from Paris, what do we need to do specifically to reduce carbon emissions?
Well, Alison, you bring up a really interesting point that was talked about a lot at the COP, and that was the place of business, the place of investors, and also the place of insurance. And they're all kind of connected. And so really with this agreement, what we are looking at is, and it is a message, that we are moving towards a low carbon, no carbon future, and that the agreement provides a strong long-term market signal that the world is locking into the low carbon future. And some were saying by 2050 or at the most by 2070, or some were saying even before 2050. And so businesses are moving on board. I was at a press conference with businesses, and they were talking about, before they came to the COP, there was so much money that they were hoping that they would have to further, for instance, renewable energy, solar, around the world. Well, by the time they got to COP, that amount had doubled. By the time COP had ended, they had more investment, and it was six times higher than the amount that they had come into with the COP. So it's talking about businesses seeing that, yes, this is the future. In terms of investment companies and investors, there really is a movement away from the fossil fuel industry, and they're seeing that as a stranded asset, and that is not the future, and we really need to be moving quickly and leaving the fossil fuels in the ground. The other business aspect is the insurance. And so probably 12 years ago, when I began to get even more intimately involved in climate change, I heard a talk by Swiss Re, which is the largest insuring company of all the insurance companies. And they at that time were concerned, but they were the first company to say, we are really looking at insurance and how we're going to deal with all these climate disasters as insurance companies. Well, now most insurance companies are on board, and they're not going to even insure certain property or certain businesses or things because of the liability that it is. So the businesses really are pushing this new clean energy future in many ways.
Yeah, let's talk about the idea of stranded carbon assets. So that was kind of one of the buzz terms that came out of Paris that we saw a lot in the press. But essentially, the reserves of fossil fuels that must stay in the ground to avert the worst climate change. And so this means that the fossil fuel industry must forgo drilling and developing of these reserves. And so we saw a lot of climate activists, and even in the lead up to the Paris talks, pushing for keep it in the ground. What do you think? Do you think that we're going to be able to do that? Do you think the fossil fuel industry is going to recognize the necessity of that?
You know, from my experience, I think that they will be moved to do that because it's no longer profitable. And those who will be pushing that is business and industry itself, also the civil society and the faith communities. Already there are a number of large-based entities in the U.S. that have divested from fossil fuel, the United Church of Christ, First Unitarian, the Episcopals. The Methodists are moving that way. I'm not sure that they've actually done it yet. My Franciscan community is divesting from fossil fuels. So just from the investment side, and I was in a meeting recently where, it was with the investor who invests the money with my community for our retirement fund for all our older sisters, and they were saying that more and more individuals and people are saying, well, we want to invest in something else. We don't want to invest in the fossil fuels. With that, just as another little example, my community does corporate responsible investing, where we take certain companies and to call them to moral accountability, we'll invest in them. And one was a coal company. And you have to have so many shares, and we had bought more than enough shares to do this, and we're holding this and doing resolutions. And we realized suddenly that we didn't have enough shares, enough money in shares to do this, simply because the price of those stocks had dropped so dramatically, so quickly.
Wow.
So the market itself is already pushing this direction. And I guess I just keep thinking, here in New Mexico, where so much of our money for our education fund and everything is with the extractive industry.
Right. So it really is now the market signals are starting to take hold to kind of push these fossil fuel dependent industries to change, is what it's sounding like. Okay.
Yeah. And as solar and other renewable technologies become much more cost effective and they don't have the carbon emissions, that will become more and more the case. And that was talked about a lot by business and industry in Paris.
So, Sister Joan Brown, will Congress interfere in agreements made by the Obama administration in Paris? And, you know, can they really stand in the way? I think you mentioned earlier in our previous segment is that the Paris agreements weren't a treaty like the Kyoto Protocol. So, you know, these agreements don't really need congressional ratification. Is that true?
That is very true. The Congress does not have to ratify this. What will be dependent upon the Congress is how fast we can move forward to even increase our ambition or what we might do. And I would just hope that our leaders would begin to see even more deeply our interconnectedness on the planet and that we're all brothers and sisters and how the climate crisis is adversely affecting millions and millions of people on the planet. And that's a huge moral and ethical dilemma that we're in. And, you know, we call ourselves a leader as the United States. And I think true leadership is really being brother and sister throughout the world in the most positive kind of way.
And it sounds like Congress is really taking on the Clean Power Plan. And is that really the principal vehicle at this point by which the U.S. is going to achieve these emission reductions that we committed to in Paris?
Well, again, there are several ways that they're met. And one is through whatever governmental kind of, not exactly legislation, but governmental rules. And the Clean Power Plan is one. And that is before the states now for implementation. Here in New Mexico, we are beginning to have conversations about putting forth our plan for that to happen. And Governor Martinez is supportive of the Clean Power Plan in our state. There are some governors that have opposed it, but she has not. And so some of us are beginning to work on that so that we have the best plan that we could have for the people of New Mexico and for the United States and for the world, really, for our brothers and sisters. So that's one of the elements, things like working on really good stewardship of the oil and gas that we have through methane release regulations is another area. So it's trying to address it through those areas. And again, the emissions will be, our promises will be met, again, through some of the things the business is doing.
That's right.
And the again, renewable energy, which reduces the carbon emissions. Automobiles that are more fuel efficient and cleaner, or electric, that's another area. Energy efficient homes in the construction industry. So there's a number of ways that we will work at meeting it.
Okay. We'll take a short break and talk more with Sister Joan Brown here on Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. Don't go away. Welcome back to Earth Matters. This is Allison Civic, Director of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. My guest today is Sister Joan Brown, Director of the New Mexico Interfaith Power and Light, and we've been talking about the Paris Climate Talks. Sister Joan was a representative to the talks, and we're getting a firsthand debrief on what happened. Sister Joan, let's shift to the role of the faith community in the Paris Talks. In general, how did you participate and other faith groups participate in the talks?
Well, there was participation in several ways. One, there were a number of different ecumenical and interfaith religious services, both in the evenings and during the day. There was an area called the Generation Climate Zone, where anybody could be, and there was a large Episcopal delegation there that had a prayer service every noon. So that was one level, the spiritual, the praying, the being present with, talking with the people who were there. The other was actually being part of some networks and coalitions, and we had organized ahead of time, actually, to do that, and what our messaging would be, and what were the areas that we really needed to address, which were, you know, finances, money for adaptation, the whole issue of loss and damage, the human rights, some of those areas. So I was privileged to be part of some of those groups that actually met with some of the negotiating parties to bring forth these elements that were really important. And among that, there were people from other faith traditions. There were Unitarians, the Marianal Sisters, the Mercy Sisters, Baha'is were there, the Buddhists, the Franciscans, different Protestant denominations. So there really was a large representation of people of faith in the actual delegation area. And I was at several presentations where those who were delegates or those who were the official facilitators of the whole process stated that this is the first time that the moral implications, the moral imperative of climate change was very, very present on the floor, the delegates' floor, and in the negotiations, and that the presence of the faith communities and individuals was very significant and important.
Yes, that moral imperative, that got a lot of discussion before the climate talks, the lead up to the talks. It was hoped by many that Pope Francis's encyclical on caring for our common home, released last summer, would provide that moral and ethical justification for why nations must commit to taking action on climate change. And I'm wondering, do you think this happened? And did the Pope have a delegation in Paris?
Well, actually, you know, the papal state is a state, so that they have delegates to this, as any other nation would. So that was interesting in itself. And yes, the Laudato Si and the Pope was very significant in this talk, and it was brought up numerous times. Also, as was the Muslim International Islamic Declaration on Global Climate Change, that was also brought up several times. I have to say, too, that Cardinal Turkesson, who was very instrumental in working on Laudato Si and has given amazing talks leading up to that document from the Vatican, was there and did a press conference, and he was very strong, and what he said was also noted. And among the things he talked about were that those who are assaulted the most are the poor and unable to defend themselves, and that we need to act. And he also brought up the idea of culpable indifference, which is something that, you know, the nations are part of, and I could say myself and us in the United States. And he said, what must unite everyone is a shared ethical framing of the common good and solidarity. Such virtues are indispensable for any transformation, for any effective commitment to change. It may be that a lack of ethical guidelines and motivation makes the current negotiations more difficult. So that voice the Laudato Si, the Vatican, and other religious traditions such as the Muslim and others were very, very present and made a huge difference.
So Laudato Si being the Pope's encyclical on caring for our common home, if people didn't recognize that title. But Sister Joan, do you think the poorer communities or you talked about the Maldives and some of these island nations that are bearing the full brunt of climate change, do you think that they went home satisfied with the agreements? Are we going to follow through with this moral imperative and take care of them?
I would say that everyone was very pleased that this happened. We have something to work with. It was historical. But we need to do more. And I would say the developing countries will be the first to say that almost. You know, this was quite a very good statement that brings forth this. After the delegation affirmed the document, South Africa spoke, and it was several beautiful South African women, because they began this work when one of the cops was in Durban. And this is what they said. They said, "The text before us is not perfect, but it is a place to move, and it is the best we can get at this historic moment. It is a turning point to a better moment." And then they talked about how we need to work more for the poor countries, for balance, and for them to leap forward for the developing countries. And they ended with something which was very a huge moral statement, I thought, coming from their place of struggle. And it was a quote from Nelson Mandela. And they said, they quoted him, and this is not his exact quote, but it's something like this: "I have walked that long road to freedom and not faltered, one hill after one great hill. There are many more hills to climb, but now is the time to rest and see the glorious vista before we continue on." So I think that every nation there would agree, and some would be more disgruntled than others that more wasn't accomplished. But I guess I respect a great deal some of these countries in the South who also are saying, you know, this is a beginning, and I think it just behooves us as a developed country to do more and to take seriously this call and this moral moment that we're in.
So, Sister Joan, you mentioned the Islamic Declaration on Global Climate Change. What does this declaration say? I'm interested to hear.
Well, it was it's very significant, and I think many people do not realize that for a number of years now, there's been a very large green Muslim movement of greening mosques, of promoting local food and caring for creation, and that rooted in their tradition. So this particular document came out in the late summer, early fall, and it was signed by many, many internationally noted Muslim leaders, and one of them was a Muslim woman who was in Washington with me, who was given one of the White House Climate of Change Awards and who's worked all over the world. So the document basically lays out the work that needs to be done in, you know, addressing lifestyle, food, energy efficiency, those things. But it's interspersed with quotes from the Quran. So it's very significant as one of the major religious traditions throughout the world working on this collectively, and just speaks again to the strength of working on things in an interfaith way. And I might also mention, related to this, Interfaith Power and Light works with a number of Muslims, and as well as Jewish and Christian and Buddhists and Baha'is. And at the COP, we were invited by the State Department of the United States to make a presentation on what faith communities in the United States are doing. And so what we have been doing is collecting signatures on the Paris Pledge by individuals and faith communities that they might reduce their carbon emissions by 50% by 2030 and to net zero by 2050. So we are modeling to the nations that, yes, we are doing this as well, and the nations or countries can do this. And so we presented that, plus a presentation on the specifics, practicalities of, you know, solar and energy efficiency and food and all of that. And we presented about 4,500 names, and we're going to continue to collect those names, and about 180 faith communities who have pledged to this. And it was an 11-foot scroll that we presented, and it was very, very well received. And we are going to continue with that campaign. So if any of the listeners would like to sign that pledge, they can go on the Interfaith Power and Light website and just look up the Paris Pledge, and they can do that and be part of that.
And what's the web address for that, Sister Joan?
Actually, they can just Google Interfaith Power and Light.
Okay. And I'm curious, were the names just from New Mexico, the names on the Paris Pledge, or was that for the entire organization?
It was from throughout the whole country, but here in New Mexico, we have gathered over 250 individual names and names from three congregations who have made this Paris Pledge. And they are First Unitarian and First Congregational Church here in Albuquerque, and the Greek Orthodox Church in Santa Fe.
Oh, great. So what I'm curious is, you mentioned this is something that you all will be continuing. Was there any kind of agreement amongst faith communities about the work that they're going to take home as a result of the Paris climate talks, or just continuing to work on programs that were already initiated before the talks? Anything new?
Well, at this point, you know, I was just on a conference call this morning, so people are debriefing, actually, still at this point from Paris. But we'll continue on certain campaigns. So, for instance, you know, the greening of congregations, the energy efficiency, the solar, the local food, and then the public policy work that we connect with the moral obligation, like the Clean Power Plan and working on the methane rules and some of those things. So we'll be continuing those things and just engaging more people in it, because we need to have everybody in this country engaged in caring for a common home and loving our brothers and sisters. And that's really what this work is about.
All right. So in our next segment, we'll talk a bit more about what we can do. So let's take a short break and talk more to Sister Joan Brown here on Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic of Healer Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. Let's continue our discussion about the Paris Climate Talks with today's guest, Sister Joan Brown of New Mexico Interfaith Power and Light. So, Sister Joan, given all of the momentum from the Paris Climate Talks, people seem to be energized to do their part. So what can people do? You talked a little bit about the Paris Pledge. Maybe you could tell us some of the specifics. What are people pledging to do?
Okay. The Paris Pledge is something initiated by Interfaith Power and Light, and it's for all people of faith or people of any spiritual conviction, and it's also for their faith communities. And it's asking that people pledge to reduce their carbon emissions by 50% by 2030 and to net zero by 2050. And I have to say, throughout the country, there are several congregations that not only have net zero, but they are producing more energy now than they use. So they are, you know, on the other side of this whole movement. So we can do that in all kinds of ways, by evaluating how much we drive. Is there other ways that we can carpool or walk? Is our homes the most energy efficient that they can be? Are we conserving water? If we're able to put solar, maybe to do solar panels. So those are some kind of practical ways. But the other area that I think is really important as well is to get engaged with what's happening civically. Like, for instance, in this state, supporting the transition to clean and renewable energy. And at this point, we still need some incentives to do that for solar. So, for instance, there's a home renewable energy tax credit that will be up for renewal at the next legislative session. And that would be great to have people right now contacting their representatives and senators about that, saying, yes, that they believe solar is good and that we need to be continuing down that path. I think sometimes people of faith are involved in certain issues. And I think one thing that we need to do is, I call it connecting the dots between all of these concerns, whether it's immigration, a number of the immigrants that we have right now, it's because at root, it's because of poverty, but a lot of that's related to what's happening in their countries with climate change. I was at a Central American exhibit in Paris, and at that Central American exhibit, they had all these pictures about how their forests had been, you know, washed away by the torrential rains, and then I saw a picture of La Bestia, the train that carries the immigrants to the north, and they said, yes, that's part of the reason that they're coming to the north. Mm-hmm. So I think to educate ourselves and to connect the dots and then to see what is it through our own reflection and discernment that we're called to do that we can do.
Yes, and in one of our earlier segments, you talked about divestment from fossil fuels and reinvestment. And is that something that people can be doing individually, or as you mentioned, even your retirement for the Franciscan Sisters? How can we do that?
Well, that's something that a lot of individuals are doing more and more, and they just need to talk with whoever works with them on their, you know, investments and where it is. And there are certainly more choices for that than there have been in the past. And if people are part of a faith community, they can look and talk about this as their faith community. Are there ways that they might divest and then reinvest? And the reinvestment is very important. Where are we putting the gifts that we've been given, and how are we stewarding that? And is it towards, you know, a future for the children and for clean energy, for protecting our brothers and sisters that are most vulnerable around the world? So those are definitely things that people can do.
So we're essentially doing our part to send a market signal that we don't want to put our money with fossil fuels anymore. We want to put our money in funds that build community, protect our environment, those sorts of things.
Right, exactly. And with that, even as we're doing that, I think one thing that Pope Francis said in Laudato Si, and actually at the very beginning, he said, this is a document that will call forth dialogue. People will not agree with everything that is in this document, but we need to talk to one another and talk about this. I think that's very significant, and that's what had to happen in Paris for the COP to be a success and to come up with an agreement. And I think we, in our communities, in our families, in our homes, we're moving through the holidays right now. We have many opportunities to talk with our families, even among disagreements about where our economy is moving, what kind of energy we use, even if climate change is real or not, or if humans are part of that. I think we need to be reaching across our comfort zones to really talk to people about these issues and these concerns. And only in doing that kind of dialogue can we come to some new places.
Right. And so what can we do in New Mexico? And you mentioned earlier some of the issues that we're talking about here at the state level, like the Clean Power Plan and the methane rule. Tell our listeners a little bit about these two pieces of legislation that are really going to help achieve very important emission reductions.
The Clean Power Plan has been worked on for a number of years now, gaining public comments, and in fact, Interfaith Power and Light across the country and in here in New Mexico gathered thousands and thousands of postcards and signatures from people of faith supporting this. And what it means is we want clean air. We want to stop the pollution. We see it's a health problem. We see that it's hurting brothers and sisters. It's causing climate change through emissions, through coal-fired power plants and other emitters. So the Clean Power Plan is stating that we have to reduce those emissions. And so now it's to each state to figure out exactly how we are going to do that. So there will be a series of meetings throughout the state over the next year to come up with exactly how we will get to that target of those emissions reduction. In terms of the methane, which comes from the gas industry, oil and gas industry, we are in a process of EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, comments, because a lot of methane is released, it's through leaks and waste. And it's not good stewardship of that resource. And some of the listeners might be aware or remember that we have, a year ago, it was displayed this enormous red cloud through NASA readings over the northwest part of the state, and it's from methane emissions. And so we need to reduce these again for the health. It is a huge impactor on climate change, and it also is a way of stewarding that resource that we have that God has given us to take care of and not waste. So those are two of the things. I also like to mention food is very important, and I think to support local food production, and that's just a huge way into the future. And it also reduces emissions because we're not trucking and transporting everything in. And it's also healthier and healthier for the children. And so there's those various elements that we can be engaged in.
And you mentioned earlier the legislative session is starting next month, January 19th, I believe, through February 18th or 19th, just a 30-day session. So what are some of the key pieces of legislation, bills that might be up this next session that we know about that people could support? You mentioned the solar tax credit. Maybe you could talk a little bit in more detail about that bill.
Right, and that is for solar tax credits that would help, you know, individuals and for homes. And we have had in the past these incentives both at the federal level and the state level. So if you put solar on your house, you pay for so much of it, but then part of it, in order to increase the solar capacity and grow that business here in New Mexico, that you get some money back, so you're not paying the full price, that there's some assistance with that. Well, those tax credits expire at the end of 2016. So we want to renew those tax credits, and there is a bill that would do that. It was at the last legislative session, and it got strong approval, but we didn't quite make it through. So, and that's pretty typical of bills here in New Mexico. So we're going at it again. And it does have a lot of strong bipartisan support because it's good for New Mexicans, it's good for individuals, and it grows a new clean energy business, which we really need to keep promoting here in the state. So I would encourage people to talk about it with their neighbors, go on the New Mexico website to find out more about that, call your legislators to say, you know, I really want to keep us moving forward with solar energy here on our homes and in the state of New Mexico.
Yeah,
so that's one of the bills.
And we'll have more information on the gmcr.org website on the Earth Matters page for people.
Right.
Yeah, is there anything else? Any other bills that you know of? I know it's still early.
It is still a little early, and some of these will be unveiled more in January. And I have to say, because I've been out of the country for a couple weeks, I'm a little not up to date on some of it because it moves kind of quickly this time of year, too. But the solar, promoting the solar energy is one of the things that Interfaith Power and Light with our congregations is quite, they're quite concerned about and want to see. So we are working on that one.
Right. So in our last couple remaining minutes to the show, Sister Joan Brown, would you like to just give our listeners some concluding thoughts from your 2 weeks at the Paris Climate Talks?
Just to say that, you know, when I was there, I took New Mexicans with me. Some of them had signed the Paris Pledge. But I just saw, in being there with these people from 200 countries throughout the world, that we really are one community. And the reality of what it means to love one another, which is the call of every religious tradition. And that now is the time to put this agreement, which is historical, into action with our lives here locally and in this country so that we really can be a leader in the world of caring for our brothers and sisters.
Well, thanks so much, Sister Joan Brown, for speaking with us today on Earth Matters. And thank you again for giving New Mexicans and faith communities a voice at the Paris Climate Talks. For more information on how you can take the Paris Pledge or for a podcast of today's program, visit Earth Matters online at www.gmcr.org. That's all the time we have today. Thank you to our audio engineer, Kyle Johnson. We hope you'll join us again for next week's edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Membris Community Radio 89.1 FM.